It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today, Donna Hoffman is in our Cedar Falls studio, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Donna.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You'll have to leave a little bit early in the hour for a meeting, but we're sure glad to have you with us for most of the hour.
Thank you.
Jim McCormick with us as well, professor of political science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
Well, let's get right to it. A little forecast of what we're going to talk about a little bit later, because we had some breaking news here in the last couple of hours. Later in the hour, we'll talk about how President Trump has put forward health care as one of the central issues of the 2020 presidential race. Congressional Republicans don't seem to have much of an appetite for that. We'll ask Donna and Jim about that. Also, the border crisis with the influx of asylum-seeking families on our southern border. How former Vice President Joe Biden's past behavior with women may impact his chances as a presidential candidate. We'll ask Jim about Brexit. The Brexit countdown next week is the deadline, I believe. Right. Also, perhaps some reflections on NATO's 70th anniversary this month. But let's start with that news we heard in the top of the hour from NPR. A little background before we get to that news from the House Judiciary Committee. Last week, we remind ourselves of the findings by the special counsel. Robert Mueller delivered some good news for President Trump and Republicans. Attorney General Barr told Congress that Mueller's office didn't establish a conspiracy between Trump's campaign and Russian interference in the 2016 election, nor did it establish, according to the attorney general again, that Trump obstructed justice. That's based on Barr's four-page letter about the report to the Congress. That's all we have to go on so far. Now the attorney general's office is working to redact a grand jury testimony, other things, foreign intelligence, before releasing a full report sometime later this month. That full document, some 400 pages, perhaps nearly that, contains a lot more detail. So this just ended in the last couple of hours as the House Judiciary Committee authorizing subpoenas for the full report and its underlying investigative evidence. I'm reading from the NPR website. The committee also authorized subpoenas for figures in the Trump orbit, including former White House counsel Don McGahn, McGahn's former chief of staff Ann Donaldson, former advisor Steve Bannon, former spokesperson Hope Hicks, and former chief of staff Reince Priebus. Donna, tell us, what do you make of this latest development with the subpoenas with all the other background?
Well, certainly Congress has the ability to use this power. So that House Judiciary Committee voted to authorize those. It remains to be seen when and if the Nadler will actually execute those and then compel that information. Because many times there's a give and a take here in terms of the negotiations that might go on between the parties in terms of the conditions of how they appear, what documents are going to be submitted, those kinds of things. But nevertheless, this is part, one of the things to emphasize is this is part of Congress's investigatory power that they have, because one of their jobs is to oversee the executive branch and to oversee how laws are carried out, and also to protect the prerogatives of Congress as an institution as well. And so, you know, this is not something I think that was a surprise. This was always hanging out there as something that Nadler in particular could potentially go forward with. Mm-hmm. There was, as we note, you know, in the events of the last week, essentially, when the report was finished, Barr's the only one that's seen it. He did his four-page summary. There was some public pressure, some discussions. Barr clarified with another letter to some of the key members of Congress as well, and then said, okay, by mid-April, I should have this redacted mm-hmm. version. So there has been this negotiation going on, and this just ratchets it up a bit.
Mm-hmm. Jim, what do you see going on here? For instance, the key questions that you would like to see, and perhaps others, cleared up by the full report.
Well, I think, first of all, this is, as Donna said, this is a kind of a bargaining leverage that Nadler and the Judiciary Committee, at least the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, are trying to utilize, and there will be this kind of back and forth bargaining. I do see ultimately, though, a clash, because I think that Barr is going to have a real problem, in terms of kind of the legal standards here, if he can release grand jury testimony or not, or sources and methods, because of course there has been, in the past, even on the Democratic side, that they wanted these sources and methods protected. So I wouldn't be surprised if, and this is really the kind of the underlying question, whether we're going to really have some real court challenges over this. I'm not sure that this is going to be easily resolved in terms of the kind of back and forth bargaining between the majority on the Judiciary Committee and the Justice Department in this case, or the Attorney General here. So I think this will be a sort of full employment activity for the Congress and for the judiciary, for the Justice Department, really through the summer here at least.
Mm-hmm. Going into the 2020 campaign, and here in Iowa, of course, the political campaign heading to 2020 already starting in full swing. Donna, how much do you think voters care about these investigations? They're obviously going to play out over the months into 2020, and perhaps right up to the race, do you think?
Well, I think Democratic primary voters in Iowa, those we would call those people caucus voters. I mean, we know that the people who vote in primaries and caucuses are the most active activists, you know, of their party that there are. And so there are going to be people within that group that care greatly about this. But at the same time, general election voters may not care about it much at all. So there will be a positioning that candidates have to do, as they always do, on the way these kinds of issues break down. But in particular, if you look at how candidates on the Democratic side ran in 2018, they tried to run on health care, for example. That's another issue that's back in the debate. And, you know, surveys of the public show, the whole public, the general public, show that other issues like the economy will take precedent. Health care, trade, depending on what kind of subpopulations you might be talking about. You know, for example, we know that several of the presidential candidates did an agriculture forum earlier in the week in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And so caucus voters are different from general election voters. And so candidates have to be prepared on whatever issues those candidates want to talk about. And so they will have a stand on what they think about the various information releases and who testifies and that kind of thing related to this investigation. But they're primarily going to talk about bread and butter issues, mm-hmm. economic issues that we know voters care most about.
Okay, you mentioned health care there. I'll remind our listeners who may have just joined us, Donna Hoffman with us of the University of Northern Iowa, Jim McCormick, our other political scientist on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's talk about a bread and butter issue, so to speak. In recent days, the president has put forward health care as one of the central issues of the 2020 presidential race. He has pledged in recent days to use that court action stemming from the Texas court case to end the Affordable Care Act. Of course, that's the signature law of the Obama era. He said his Republican Party would push over the next few months for a better health care plan at a lower cost for most Americans. Here he is speaking out at a Grand Rapids, Michigan rally last Thursday and making a veiled promise about new health care initiatives intended to replace the Affordable Care Act.
But we got rid of the individual mandate where you were forced to pay a lot of money for the privilege of not having to buy bad health care, okay? Not too good. So we're going to get rid of Obamacare. And I said it the other day, the Republican Party will become the party of great health care. It's good. It's important.
Okay, the next chapter came very quickly in this. Yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell responded to the president's call for a full overhaul of the Affordable Care Act, saying the Senate will not take on comprehensive reform.
So I made it clear to him we were not going to be doing that in the Senate. He did say, as he later tweeted, he accepted that, and that he would be developing a plan that he would take to the American people during the 2020 campaign, and suggest that that would be what he would be advocating in a second term if there were a Republican Congress. So we don't have a misunderstanding about that. We'll not be doing comprehensive in the Senate.
Okay, Donna, what do you make of this announcement by Donald Trump and then the about face due to the apparent Republican backlash?
Well, I mean, I think Trump shoots from the hip on this issue, as many others, and has merely, you know, tweeted that he wants the GOP to be the party of health care. McConnell's, you know, a practical politician. He says, look, we're not going to take this up. The House isn't going to pass anything that we pass because the House is controlled by Democrats. And then Trump has to, you know, make make allowances in terms of what he tweets after that. So now the replacement plan, as it would be called, would be, you know, after the 2020 election. Now, this sets up then healthcare as an even bigger election issue than it potentially was anyway.
Right.
Because it and potentially to the detriment of the Republican candidates, because while we already had the White House and the DOJ, by extension of that, weighing in on this particular case that's going to be before the Fifth Circuit. It started at the district court, as you mentioned. They were only not supporting the pre-existing condition aspect of that lawsuit, which is one of the very popular aspects of the Affordable Care Act. Then they kind of adjusted that position and said, no, we would support that original district court ruling, and we encourage the Fifth Circuit to strike down the whole entire act. That is an important change, but it also then makes it much more clear, I think, in the minds of voters in terms of where they stand and where they don't stand, setting this up as a pretty easy type issue in the scope of an election in which you can say Democrats are for ACA, Republicans are against it, and then there is nothing to replace it with. But that discussion has to take place as part of the election. And so this was an issue that Trump didn't necessarily need to weigh in on in a public way like this and expose the differences between himself and McConnell in particular. Democrats already had a discussion going on amongst themselves about should we just tweak the ACA, should we do Medicare for all? And Trump kind of stepped on the message here.
Mm-hmm. For years, Jim, let me put this to you. Of course, the GOP campaigning on full repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Why no enthusiasm for that on campaigning now from many Republicans we see here this last few days?
Well, I think part of the problem is they really can't agree on what the replacement plan would look like. And my own sense is that despite what Trump's statement here is about coming up with a new plan before the election, I think that's probably not going to occur. That they're going to instead, and really McConnell really sort of tipped the hand on this, what they really want to do is to be able to attack the Democrats in terms of the Affordable Care Act and the rising costs and the problem of coverage here, the deductibles and so on, and the premiums are rising. So I think that they really want to do that because I think there is sort of real dissidence among Republicans in terms of what they should do. I mean, this whole issue that Donna mentioned in terms of pre-existing conditions, is there going to be unity among Republicans on that and with the White House? Now, they have said that they will, but I'm really doubtful. I'm really doubtful that they can come up with a plan that they can agree upon that all the Republican candidates want to run on. After all, they're, the Senate Republicans have more senators that they have to put up in this election. And, this is a kind of a dangerous issue for them. And to be in the attack mold, I think, is a better position for them than to try to embrace a plan that hasn't been fully vetted and fully discussed.
Well, you can argue that this puts Democrats in the attack mode, Jim,
sure.
Doesn't it? Because, let's listen to a little bit of the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer firing back at the president for saying he now plans to hold off on health care reform until after the 2020 election.
President Trump confirmed he'll hold Americans hostage through the 2020 elections when it comes to health care. He promises, reelect me, and then maybe I'll let you take a peek at my backup plan after that, which they don't have. What a ruse. What a sham. And even more, what a disgrace.
So, Jim, this is what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it does allow the Democrats to do that. But, putting a plan out there by the Republicans that they haven't really agreed and vetted on, I think is even more dangerous in terms of a campaign strategy.
Mm-hmm. Looking at a new Politico Morning Consult poll, voters, according to this poll just out, are skeptical of the president's renewed push to dismantle the ACA health care law. 59% of 59%, a majority of voters say they don't have much trust or any trust at all in President Trump on health care. Asked whom they trust when it comes to health care, 45% of voters pick Democrats in Congress. 35% choose Republicans in Congress. So, Donna, this backs up that the Democrats are cheering here a little bit. We'll see.
Sure, it does. And, again, back to the point that you and Jim were discussing also, let's recall that the Republicans One had unified control after the 2016 election, and also brought what was called the skinny ACA repeal up for a vote in July of 2017, and it was not successful. So they have had a plan, but it was just a repeal plan. It wasn't a replacement plan. And even that they couldn't agree on to move forward. And so, you know, again, this is a really difficult issue and has a lot of moving pieces to it. And that makes it very difficult for either party many times to agree on exactly what the course is to move forward.
And even the proposal that they had in terms of what they the Graham Kennedy proposal, apparently, that was put forward, would still leave so many people uncovered that in terms of insurance. That would be, you know, I think, at least electorally, very, very dangerous for the Republicans.
Okay. It's the Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Let's talk about immigration, the latest chapter there. Last Friday, the president threatening to close the border with Mexico unless Mexico took steps to help the U.S. with illegal immigration. Yesterday, Donald Trump saying he was prepared to close the southern border if necessary, but that Mexico has apprehended thousands of people in recent days, and its actions have made a big difference in the immigration situation, according to the president. Donna, help us understand the politics of what's going on concerning the southern border.
Well, if I could do that in you know, 5 minutes, I could do a lot of things. But let me just say this. So there are, you know, this has been an issue ongoing. And Trump, before the 2018 election in particular, made a big deal about sending troops to the border because of these migrant caravans that were coming forward, which was not an unusual thing. This is a seasonal, you know, kind of happening. But this is a multi-pronged problem. And one of the newer things related to what's happening here is that a lot of these migrants are seeking asylum. They're coming up from Central America, in particular from Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador. And in the midst of more migrants arriving in the month of March in particular, the Trump administration has said they're going to cut aid to what are called the Northern Triangle countries as well. Now, these people are fleeing these countries because of violence in these countries, because of instability in these countries. And that's kind of the root cause of the immigration movement that we're seeing from that area into the United States.
Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador.
Correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And so cutting aid, which doesn't go to the countries themselves, they go to non-governmental organizations to do various humanitarian activities, quite, you know, most typically, and sometimes they work with police forces and that kind of thing, in terms of trying to stabilize the country, trying to alleviate humanitarian concerns within the country, trying to make it so people don't uproot their entire existence to come across Mexico to, you know, the United States. And that is particularly problematic if you're trying to stem the immigration movement that you have here, and then you're wanting to cut aid to those particular areas as well. And so this is an area where, of course, Congress has the power of the purse, but they appropriate money to the State Department to administer this money, and then they have some flexibility. Congress could, of course, be more specific in the way that they, in future budgets, in the way that they dictate how this money is spent. So that's kind of an ongoing thing. And then you have Trump threatening to close the border. And this is something Trump has threatened multiple times before. And it's not really clear what he means when he says he wants to close the border, mm-hmm. although technically closing the border would mean people, and that would include goods aren't getting through. And there have been some other people within the administration still kind of saying, well, maybe if we close the borders, we'd still allow goods through. So I'm not exactly sure what they envision here. But there have already been effects from even the threatening here. So, for example, one of the ones that I've seen most recently is that already avocado prices, which, you know, in the United States mostly come from Mexico and Central America, avocado prices have already gone up 34%, I believe it was. And so you would have automobile manufacturers being affected by this because certain parts are manufactured south of the border that come into the United States. This could be a very large disruption of trade. And then for Iowa, of course, mm-hmm. You know, Mexico is our third largest trading partner in the United States. But the top agricultural product that the United States exports to Mexico is corn. And so that could disrupt that further on top of tariffs that we already have going on with other countries.
Jim, what do you think about the president's plans or words about possibly closing the border and about cutting aid to these three Central American countries?
Well, I think the trade impact would be really quite severe to do that. As they say, $500 million worth of trade goes across that, or $500 million worth of trade goes across the border every day. And so you're really talking about lots of trade for the United States with Mexico. It's our, was mentioned, it's our third largest trading partner in the world here. And so that would be terribly disruptive here in terms of the relationship that the United States has with Mexico. I think the aid issue, Donna has put her finger on it. I mean, here you have this desire by these non-governmental organizations to try to help this humanitarian crisis, and this aid is going to be denied to them. So I think that's problematic. On the other side, though, I think one of the other pieces of this is that this humanitarian crisis that really does exist on the border there has really gotten even some Democratic support, if you noticed here. The former Homeland Security Secretary for the Obama administration has come out and has recognized this kind of issue. So,
Jim, does that then, going by what you said, does that put pressure on the Democrats to come up with a plan to not just oppose President Trump's actions here?
Well, the whole issue is immigration reform, and it does. I mean, one of the presidential candidates, Julian Castro, has put forward a plan that, he wants to use in terms of trying to do something about the immigration issue. And so I do think it puts it back on the table. And certainly, of course, it keeps it as part of this 2020 election campaign issue as well.
Okay. We're going to go away for a few minutes and come back with our analysts, Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University, Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. If you'd like to join our conversation on anything that we've talked about. Also going forward, we're going to talk about the new NAFTA and how Congress is receiving that, specifically the U.S. House under Nancy Pelosi. Also, former Vice President Joe Biden's past behavior with women under a lens right now. We'll ask our analysts how that may affect his presidential candidate chances. And Brexit, Venezuela, plenty of other things. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100 or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes with more of Politics Wednesday. Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Donna Hoffman with us of the University of Northern Iowa, where she's a professor of political science. Jim McCormick, also professor of political science, but at Iowa State University in Ames, with us this hour. Donna, actually with us for another 10 minutes or so. Let's get right to talk about this controversy this week surrounding former Vice President Joe Biden's past behavior with women. Joe Biden, long known for his affectionate mannerisms. Two women have said Biden touched them inappropriately in the past. Amy Lapos, a former aide to Democratic Representative Jim Himes of Connecticut, on Monday saying that Biden touched her face with both hands and rubbed noses in 2009. Former Nevada politician Lucy Flores, penning a magazine essay last week, she wrote that Biden kissed her on the back of the head in 2014. Donna, what do you make of these accusations and the possible damage this does to Joe Biden's potential candidacy?
Well, it certainly brings up issues that that Joe Biden has potentially had with women that go back to the Anita Hill. Now, these are differences, but still highlight issues that he has. That he might not exactly get women all the time. And so none of these accusations are really about him being inappropriate sexually. They're more of the notion that he's inappropriate in terms of invading personal space. Some women are going to react differently to this than other women. And that he has been kind of clueless on this in a lot of respects. So, this is not something that probably is disqualifying for him, but but you know, first he has to make the decision that he's going to run. This is happening in the environment in which he is, he may have already made that decision, but he hasn't announced it yet. This is happening in the environment which may, you know, particularly have bearing on whether he decides to get in or out. Mm-hmm. And if he does decide to get in, then it's up to voters, in particular here, we're talking again about those Democratic caucus and primary voters, to determine if this is disqualifying or not. But, you know, this has been a public discussion we've been having about men's behavior toward women in the public sphere and whether these are disqualifying things or not. But, you know, there were very serious sexual allegations made against Donald Trump in the course of the campaign. And I will point out that he's the sitting president. And so we as a country are still wrestling with the relationships that go on here in public and in private with politicians who have, issues that come out, that then their political careers are potentially affected. But again, this brings up some of the policy-oriented things that Biden has been associated with in the past, in particular the Anita Hill hearings that happened back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Right. And interesting, too, when you mention about the present president and the 2016 campaign and the 2018 midterms, we've had Democratic politics dominated by energy from women. In 2018 especially. So that is an interesting sort of thread in this story, is it not, Donna?
Yes, it particularly is. And, you know, I would also point out that in Virginia we have, you know, allegations of sexual misconduct by the sitting lieutenant governor, and he's still the sitting, you know, lieutenant governor. Those are still ongoing, but kind of the media circus around it, the hubbub around it, the media attention to it really has kind of, at least on the national stage, we're not in Virginia, obviously, but at least on the national stage has really receded. So the question really becomes, what's the extent to which politicians can explain and then survive these kinds of allegations? And when do they, you know, decide to back off of the public stage? And, you know, that, again, these things are happening. This discussion is happening at the point that Joe Biden is deciding whether he's going to run or not, or at least whether he's going to make that decision public anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Donna, I know you have to go in a couple minutes. I'll say goodbye for now. Hang around as long as you can. I want to turn to Jim now. Donna, thank you for joining us.
Sure. Thanks, Ben.
Jim McCormick, what do you see as the nature of the challenge that Joe Biden faces overcoming this controversy and weighing? He's still weighing his candidacy, evidently.
Well, I think he tried to explain it in terms of, you know, that and other people that have talked about him said that this has always been Biden's style here. And he really denied that he was acting inappropriately. He made that fairly strong statement on Sunday that he certainly will listen to now. He understands that the environment has changed, and I suspect that will lead to a change in the kind of procedures that and behaviors that he will engage in. I can just tell from one sort of personal incident when he came to speak here at Iowa State. This is several years ago. I remember seeing him talking to somebody and putting both his hands on the person's shoulder here and getting very close to them. I mean, I thought it was a little bit, you know, sort of the space issue that was talked about, you know, invading people's space. But that was sort of his style that he would do at all times. I suspect that approach was really kind of second nature to him, mm-hmm. and he hadn't given much thought to it. Now, as it's been brought to his attention, I suspect that is, what he'll not only change his behavior, but he'll probably speak about this on numerous occasions that he had no intention of, in any way, acting inappropriately and so on. But I think he will have to gain, say a caucus tender's votes. He has gained some already. I noticed that Nancy Pelosi said this is not disqualifying kind of behavior. And I wonder if there will be others that, come out and speak in his favor in terms of saying this was just Biden acting as Biden has always done. And he's had this considerable history. But I think they will also put up the red flag saying, probably this is the time, not only probably, this is the time that there will be need for a change in behavior.
Right. And Nancy Pelosi, I see, also saying, keep with some words of advice at a breakfast hour Washington event yesterday. Join the straight arm club, she said. Just pretend you have a cold and I have a cold, Pelosi said. Donald Trump weighing in a little bit more sarcastically at, I think, at a rally, saying, speaking somewhere, he says, "Welcome to the world, Joe." This was a fundraising dinner for the Republican House races. You having a good time, Joe?" the president said. This coming from, of course, a president that has denied multiple accusations of sexual misconduct on his part. Let's have a quick comment from you, Jim, on the controversy over security clearances for the White House staff. The High House Oversight Committee yesterday issuing subpoenas related to the White House security clearance process. That panel, led by Chairman Elijah Cummings of a Democrat, voted on a resolution to subpoena the testimony of former White House personal security director Carl Klein to discuss this process at the White House. Cummings revealed on Monday that a White House whistleblower, Tricia Newbold, had told Republican and Democratic committee staffers that 25 denials for security clearances had been overturned during the Trump administration. What do you make of this controversy, Jim?
Well, I think it's a real problem. I mean, you have these bureaucrats who are really their mission is to determine the eligibility for some of these individuals that will be given these kind of clearance, and then they're simply overridden by political kind of considerations here. I think that's really a problem. Now, I will be interested to see, and I haven't seen the list of the 25 people involved. I don't know if that's been revealed or not, but I've been led to believe that some of them are sort of lower level officials here that the overruling took place. But there are also some very close advisors to the president that were overruled, and that seems troubling to me in the sense that here you have a system that is at least have the potential of being compromised, I guess is the most cautious kind of language that I could use if there is this kind of constant political overriding of this. I think we really have to get into, as undoubtedly this kind of subpoena and subsequent hearings will reveal, as to what were the issues. I mean, some of the issues that were raised, at least I've seen in the reports, is that they had, you know, foreign contacts and that sort of thing, you know, and those have to all be fully reported. I know that even in the terms of Jared Kushner and finally him getting full clearance was that, you know, that he had not revealed all of his foreign contacts. So maybe it was a matter of not providing all of the necessary information, or maybe there really was a kind of a concerning kind of issue. But it is troubling that people that have responsibility for making these assessments are going to simply be overridden by the political operatives.
Let's talk about the 70th anniversary of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. The NATO Secretary Jens Stoltenberg was at the White House this week, marking that 70th anniversary. President Trump focusing yesterday on the money paid by members of the historic U.S.-European alliance. Listen to him. He met with the Secretary General before the press at the White House and expressed his belief that NATO has become stronger under his presidency. That was before critiquing the system of burden sharing between NATO member states.
I mean, Germany, honestly, is not paying their fair share. So we're paying for a big proportion of NATO, which basically is protecting Europe. So we're protecting Europe. At the same time, they've taken advantage of us on trade. So we have the best of all worlds. We're protecting countries that have taken advantage of the United States on trade. But it's all changing. It'll take a little while, but it's all changing.
Okay, Jim, characterize how you see this president has changed our relationship within NATO.
Well, he certainly has been more vocal and more continuously vocal on NATO spending on defense. That actually has, as the Secretary General made clear in some of his announcements, that actually has increased defense spending. It's projected that there will be $100 billion more in defense spending by the NATO allies. you know, because of some of this vocal browbeating, if you will, by President Trump. But I would remind our listeners too, this whole issue of burden sharing is not really new with President Trump. One citation that I saw that every president back to Dwight Eisenhower has raised the issue of burden sharing with regard to NATO. Mm. Having said that, I think the other side of it is, and what we ought to make clear, is exactly how important and how crucial NATO has been to American foreign policy. It's far and away the most important alliance structure that the United States has in the international system. And in fact, I would go even a bit further than that. I think it's probably the finest security alliance structure in the global community here. Because, you know, as you know, NATO has not only been involved in protecting Europe, as President Trump said in that clip that you had, but NATO has also been involved what's called out of area of activities here, whether it's in the Balkans or in Afghanistan or in piracy in the Indian Ocean and so on. So it has taken a very, very large role in contributing to global security, not just to Western security or in the North Atlantic Alliance. Mm-hmm. Security here. So I think the NATO alliance cannot be understated as its importance. Traditionally, it's sort of the first prominent alliance structure that the United States created after World War II. I mean, there was a real pact before it, but NATO came along and has been the most sustained. It has grown now to 29 members. It's on the verge of having a 30th member. It's really been a bulwark of American foreign policy.
Jim, isn't the real twist here, though, under Donald Trump, that he sees, as he sees almost all issues, in a transactional way? And NATO has not been viewed that way. Here we see him say, listen, we are protecting Europe. What are we getting out of it in terms of trade? He wants to link those two. And that hasn't been in the 70-year history up to now the case, right?
That's right. We have the bargain that was struck really with the creation of NATO and the rebuilding of Europe was that we would provide their security and they could go about rebuilding their economies after World War II. The Marshall Plan and then the successor. We have always been a big proponent of the European Union. I mean, John Kennedy, as early on, talked about a United States of Europe, you know, which was a precursor to really getting the European Union up and running. So we've always been supportive of that, and that has been the kind of the trade-off. But also be careful. The Trump administration, but without all of their browbeating with regard to the Europeans, have actually been spending more, particularly on the European Deterrence Initiative, or previously the Obama administration called it the European Reassurance Initiative. The budget for that continues to go up. We spend about $5 billion. You know, we now have the Obama administration started rotating troops or American presence, particularly into the Baltic region here, and that has really continued under the Trump administration. So there is a little bit of disjuncture between some of these statements that have taken place and the actions that the Trump administration has also undertaken.
Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. In the final 5 minutes or so, Jim, let's have you comment on Brexit coming down to the wire next week, the deadline, as the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Theresa May, tries to forge a Brexit compromise with the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn. The rank-and-file lawmakers trying to find a way to avert the worst-case scenario. We've heard about it for weeks, a no-deal Brexit. Now, in a statement yesterday, the British Prime Minister requested another extension on Article 50 of the Treaty of the European Union. This is the article that allows any member state to leave the EU in accordance with their own constitutional requirements. Theresa May, hoping the extension will allow for a deal to be reached before Great Britain exits the EU.
I know there are some who are so fed up with delay and endless arguments that they would like to leave with no deal next week. I've always been clear that we could make a success of no deal in the long term, but leaving with a deal is the best solution. So we will need a further extension of Article 50, one that is as short as possible and which ends when we pass a deal.
So, Jim, I've been waiting to ask you about this because we've been soaking it up in the news, all the revelations out of the British Parliament, the back and forth there. What do you make of it? What will happen? I guess the big question, but what's going on, first of all?
Well, you know, they've had at least three, maybe four votes now in which, you know, the Prime Minister's proposals have been turned down here. And now she has finally really turned, as you mentioned, to Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, to see if a deal can be devised that would have majority support. On the other hand, the EU has announced, at least the chief negotiator on Brexit for the EU, has announced that they're not inclined to give any extension to the British here. So we're really coming up to this April 12th deadline, which is, you know, a little more than a week away here, of where Britain would have to exit with no deal. And that would be, by all measures, apparently that would be really catastrophic for not only for the British, but also for the EU as well.
Mm-hmm. Explain that a little bit. We have a couple minutes left.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because there's so many financial centers that are associated with the EU within Britain here, if it suddenly is cut off, that would also be very disruptive to the economy of the EU here. I think that's principally. The other thing that would be cut off, of course, is the single market here, which is a kind of a single market that cuts across the European Union. And that would also be extremely disruptive. A third factor would be the whole immigration treatment and treatment of refugees here that would be disruptive by a no deal Brexit exit. It would leave a number of people really in limbo in terms that have immigrated, say to Britain here. Mm-hmm. So on these economic side and on the social side, to say nothing about what would that do in terms of the kind of political relationship. I don't anticipate any kind of great antagonism, but nonetheless, it would disrupt any kind of political relationship. So there are, on these kind of socioeconomic and political levels, no deal exit would be extraordinarily troublesome for both partners, actually.
Mm-hmm. Jim, seen through the eyes of the lens of U.S. foreign policy, does the U.S. have a dog in this fight? Does it matter?
Well, you know, the Trump administration has said, of course, or at least I should say President Trump personally has said he'd like the British to leave and then we could negotiate a separate trade, a very good trade relationship with the British here. I suppose that's a possibility, but that's really not the favorable kind of outcome because, as we talked about before with regard to NATO, the principal trading partner of the United States, in sum, is the European Union. And to have any disruption in that trade relationship would be dislocating for the American economy as well. And so I don't think that that's a favorable outcome, even if it could be replaced by a bilateral British-American trade relationship. Because Britain, of course, has fallen down as one of us. It's still a principal trading partner, but has fallen down the list. It's really been the EU writ large that has been the principal trading partner for the United States. And in the global arena, individual countries are larger, China and Canada and Mexico, but as a whole, our relationship is really tied very much, trade relationship is very much tied to the European Union.
And with that, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, we're going to say goodbye for this week and look forward to having you again on our Politics Wednesday. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you very much, Ben.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop and Emily Woodbury. Help today from Stephanie Nobrega as well, Sean McClain in Ames, and Chris Fenton in Cedar Falls. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about hospital delirium, a condition that can impact patients and families. We'll talk about what is to be done to prevent this tomorrow on the program, among other items. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.